Tonight, Hudson Taylor, God's Apostle to China. As we look at examples of excellence, Hudson Taylor stands out as absolutely amazing example of excellence in missions. He was consecrated from before his birth. Hudson Taylor's father, James Taylor, before his birth, knelt beside his 24-year-old wife, Amelia, in the parlor at the back of their busy chemist shop in Yorkshire, England, and prayed, "Dear God, if you should give us a son, grant that he may work for you in China." By age 4, Hudson would declare, "When I'm a man, I mean to be a missionary and go to China." Also by age 4, he had learnt the Hebrew alphabet. Hudson was home educated and he grew up in a godly home. However, by age 17, he was severely backslidden, restless and rebellious against his parents. In June 1849, when he was 17, his mother locked herself in a room 50 miles from where Hudson Taylor was and determined to pray for her son that he would be converted. And she would not leave the room until she assured that her prayers had been answered. That same afternoon, Hudson Taylor picked up a gospel tract and was struck by the phrase, "The finished work of Christ." And light was flashed into my soul by the Holy Spirit. There was nothing to be done but to fall down on my knees and pray for salvation. As he rushed breathlessly to tell his mother how he had been born again, she interrupted him and told him that she already knew. Only a mother can be like that. Hudson Taylor wrote of the intense longing for God that gripped him. "From that time, the conviction never left me," he said, "that I was called to be a missionary to China." Immediately began to prepare himself by studying the Chinese language through a copy of St. Luke's Gospel in Mandarin. He denied himself comforts and he imposed disciplines on himself to prepare himself for the mission field. He undertook work amongst the poor and the sick. He read avidly on China. He threw himself into studying Latin and Greek, theology and medicine. Hudson immersed himself in the Bible and prayer, including an entire night of intense prayer. One word came to characterize Hudson Taylor: faith. He determined to trust in God alone for all his needs. That's not to say that he didn't struggle with doubt. He did. But he persevered until faith won. He loved to give to God, and so tithing was soon left far behind as he gave away 2/3 of his income. His maxim became, "See if you can do without." In this way, he's very similar to David Livingstone, who was determined to live on the least amount possible and give away as much as possible of his income. Hudson Taylor's concern for China grew into an overwhelming burden, and he felt as though Christ's compassion for the multitude was flooding his soul. Meeting a missionary to China, Hudson excitedly told him of his plans. The missionary discouraged him, telling him the Chinese would never receive him on account of his fair hair. The Chinese are renowned for being the most xenophobic people imaginable, extremely close to foreigners and very hostile to foreigners. In fact, foreign devil is a compound noun over in China. To them, the foreigners, and they have an absolute loathing for fair hair, light colored eyes, and so he was told, you know, "They'll never accept you, you're blonde." So later, trying to dye his hair black, he was injured and almost blinded when the ammonia mixture exploded in the glass bottle he was mixing. Remember, he's a chemist's son. He had access to these sort of things. He's mixing in the bottle with gadoon. I mean, he could have easily got blind. It was a very dangerous attempt to change his hair color. In 1853, as the Taiping Rebellion broke out, Hudson Taylor, just 21 years old, said an emotional goodbye to his mother and sailed from England. And he went to China at war, severe war. The journey he took by sea took 6 months to reach his mission field. 6 months! Think what you've done in the last 6 months. Imagine if all you could have done was be on a ship trying to get to where you're going to. Included going through a severe storm. By the time Hudson Taylor landed in Shanghai, 1854, the rebels held the city and 50,000 imperial soldiers besieged it. Horrific sounds and sights greeted him. China was passing through immense upheavals. There were several major uprisings in China in the 1850s and 1860s, two of them resulting in 25 million people dead. These are colossal conflicts. Another 10 million died in just a 1.5 year famine from 1877 to 1879 during this famine in the north of the country. There were also wars between China and Britain, France, Russia, Japan. This hardly seemed to be the best time for a missionary to go to China. But Hudson Taylor was gripped by the fact that some 380 million people in a vast interior had never seen a Westerner. They'd never heard the name of Christ, many of them. And he determined to change it. The house Hudson was staying in Shanghai was struck by gunfire. The house next to his was destroyed. Nevertheless, he gave himself to the study of language and to evangelism and to helping the victims of the war. Imagine learning language of a country while your area is being shelled. That's a bit distracting. During these fearsome upheavals, Hudson traveled to take the gospel to previously unevangelized areas. One of these trips was a 200-mile journey up the Yangtze River. He frequently witnessed people being beheaded, and he himself came close to being lynched on a number of occasions. It was during this time that he developed a brief but deep friendship with William Chambers Burns, famous Scottish missionary, and they determined together to adopt Chinese dress, revolutionary for that time. Burns and Taylor were men of one heart and mind. They stayed at Swatow, a centre of the opium trade, in the most wicked place imaginable. Burns was taken prisoner during their time in Swatow. Hudson Taylor's decision to shave his head and adopt Chinese dress was rooted in his deep respect for Chinese culture and his view of the role of the missionary. Also, he found that easier than dyeing his hair. Many Chinese objected to Christianity, argued, because it seemed to be a foreign religion. So his goal was to remove anything that could be a distraction from the people so they could get the gospel itself as pure as possible. But his decision was greeted with derision and contempt by most Westerners. Well, for his part, Taylor thought that most of the missionaries to China were worldly, lacking in dedication, and ineffective. So there's kind of mutual disdain for one another's strategy and tactics. Hudson Taylor had already had his proposal for marriage rejected by two women in England. He then met and courted a missionary teacher, Maria Dyer, the much sought-after, very prestigious 20-year-old daughter of very prestigious missionary parents. And the missionary establishment was horrified at this unsophisticated missionary who had gone native wearing Chinese dress, and of course they opposed the marriage. However, Maria showed herself to be of equal dedication to Hudson Taylor, and on 20th of January 1858, Hudson Taylor and Maria Dyer became husband and wife. And this was an uncommonly happy marriage, largely because they shared the same deep passion to evangelize China at great personal sacrifice. There are examples of very successful missionary marriages, and these are one of them. We didn't get that from William Carey's first marriage, and certainly the Wesleys and Whitfields had catastrophic marriages.
Livingston's
marriage was not a happy one, not that it was as stormy as poor William Carey's. But at least the Taylors represent one of those successful unions. As was the Judsons. Adoniram and Ann Judson were very successful marriages. In fact, all three. I've got a book called The Three Mrs. Judsons. Yeah. I mean, each one died. So it was very legitimate, and he had lots of children to care for. But, I mean, that's an extraordinary story, the three Mrs. Judsons. From the start, the Taylors were frequently in danger, and their first child, Grace, was born with a riot raging outside. And Hudson Taylor's missionary partner, Dr. Parker, who had opened a clinic at Ningpo, was forced to return to Scotland when his wife died. Now, notice here, you can see the Taylor's house. And that's the window where they had a rope ladder ready to let down, because the only way they could escape if they were attacked by a mob, and attacks by mobs were common, this is their escape route. So that window, they had a rope ladder inside ready to drop down at a moment's notice to escape. And, of course, xenophobic attacks, burning out and murdering of foreigners was commonplace in China. With supplies dwindling and Hudson Taylor's health deteriorating, he had to make the painful decision to close the medical clinic and return to England. And there he was to remain for 6 years. But this temporary retreat proved to be the precursor to a great missionary advance. His burden for inland China was becoming overwhelming, and the only relief he could find was in prayer and the Word of God. First, earnest prayers to God to thrust forth laborers. Second, the deepening of the spiritual life of the church, so that the men should be unable to stay at home. In 1865, Hudson dictated a book, China, Its Spiritual Need and Claims, to Maria, while he restlessly paced up and down the floor. One paragraph declared, "Can all the Christians of England sit still with folded arms while these multitudes in China are perishing, perishing for lack of knowledge? The lack of that knowledge which England possesses so richly, which has made England what England is and made us what we are. What does the Master teach us? Is it not that if one sheep out of 100 be lost, we to leave the 99 and seek that one? But here the proportions are almost reversed. We stay at home with the one sheep and take no heed to the 99 perishing." Hudson knew that a new missionary organization dedicated to the evangelization of inland China was needed. But at this point, he found himself racked with doubt. He rarely slept for more than 2 hours at a time. He agonized over the desperate spiritual plight of China and with what he called his unbelief. He feared taking responsibility for sending young men and women into the interior of China where they would be subjected to rejection. No doubt they would. And illness. And severe persecution. It was inevitable, but that was the price that had to be paid to reach inland China. He thought he was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. He wrote, "For two or three months, intense conflict, I thought I would lose my mind. One Sunday morning he slipped out of church after worship, unable to bear the sight of a congregation, of 1,000 or more Christian people rejoicing in their own security, while millions are perishing for lack of knowledge." He wrote that as he wandered on the sands of Brighton Beach, alone and in great spiritual agony, "But during this prayer walk, the Lord conquered my unbelief, and I surrendered myself to God for this service. I told him that all the responsibility must rest with him, that as a servant it was mine to obey and to follow him, his to direct, to care for, and to guide me, and those who might labor with me." Immediately wrote in the margin of his Bible, "Prayed for 24 willing, skillful laborers, Brighton, June 25, 1865. The China Inland Mission that Hudson now planned to launch was innovative and radical for the time. He launched the world's first truly interdenominational faith mission. Up till this time, missions were all denominational, and you had to have subscriptions and raising money and offerings and all the rest of it. But he was going to have a faith mission, interdenominational, but more than that. You'll see how he had six distinctive features that were revolutionary for the time. From the first, Taylor determined that the China Inland Mission would have six distinctive features. Number one, its missionaries would be drawn from any denomination, provided they'd sign its evangelical Protestant doctrinal statement. Number two, CIM missionaries would receive no salaries, but would put their trust in the Lord to supply their needs. He had to do this because he didn't have a denominational backing. So there was no support base to guarantee salaries as a denomination could do. Income would be shared, debts, no debts would be incurred. Oh man, no man, anything but to love one another. That's from Romans. Number three, no appeals for funds would be made. Number four, the work abroad would not be directed by the home committee, but by himself, eventually other leaders in the field in China. This is quite radical. Up till then, all missions were run from London, or New York, or Washington, wherever, but now it's going to be run from the field. Radical. Fifthly, the organization would press on into the interior of China where Christ has not been named. Up till then, all missions were on the coast, where it's just easy to have supply and protection on. But he is going to go in the hinterland, where there's no protection possible from your own home country. Six, the missionaries would wear Chinese clothing and worship in Chinese-style buildings. In addition, this is also quite radical, actually. They could make this number seven. CIM would use lay workers rather than ordained ministers. And it would accept single women as missionaries. Up till that time, the only women who could enter into missions were married women. This is radical, radical, radical. Hudson Taylor's an innovator, but what he did actually showed the way for missions for the next century. Within the year, Hudson and Maria Taylor and their four children set sail for China with 16 young missionaries on board. Soon there were 24 China Inland missionaries in China, and God's blessings on the new enterprise were soon evident, because on the journey out, 20 of the ship's crew made commitments to Christ during the voyage. In fact, the ship's a very good place for outreach. I might say that Bill Bathman, when he was going to Europe and back to America, he was always having nightly evangelistic meetings in the dining halls and so on the ships. And as he said, you've got this captive audience, they can't go anywhere. But within the year, the new mission was engulfed in opposition, dissension, controversy, fire, and death. I mean, China was a hard field. In 1867, the tailor's daughter Grace died. Their mission house in Yangchau was attacked and set on fire. Furious persecution engulfed them. As Hudson Taylor wrote, "If the Spirit of God works mightily, we may be sure that the spirit of evil will also be active." Undeterred, Hudson treated more than 200 patients a day, with one of his converts, Suit, preaching to those waiting for medical treatment. Hudson made enormous demands on himself. I mean, what doctor would see 200 patients a day? Do you know anybody, any medical person, who see 100 in a day? Hudson Taylor expected equally high standards from his CIM missionaries. One of his new missionaries, Louis Nickel, grew increasingly bitter and resentful of Taylor's style of leadership and spent his time visiting other missionaries and grumbling. He had a gift of criticism. And Louis Nickel soon abandoned the Chinese dress, claiming English clothes gave him more protection and more respect. "I will not be bound neck and heel to any man," he declared. He started a sort of mutiny within the ranks. And after nearly 2 years of unpleasantness and disruption, Hudson regretfully dismissed Nickel from the mission, mainly for unrelenting slander and lies. With hindsight, he took too long to make a decisive move. When a person starts doing this, you shouldn't wait a month. In fact, as some missionaries have said, you need three things for any ministry. You need competence, you need spirituality, and you need loyalty. Competence, we can always improve our competence through training, if we're teachable. Spirituality, there's always room for growth there, as long as it's a basic core. But loyalty, it's either there or it isn't. If a person's not loyal, as I've heard from many, there's nothing you can do to restore loyalty. If a person's disloyal, walk him to the door, take his keys, and send him packing. Because he will be poison for everybody else. A disloyal worker. And this Nickel should never have been allowed to stay, in fact, another night after it was clear that he was disloyal. But Hudson Taylor, not experienced in leading men, put up with this junk for 2 years. Major amount of damage was done. Three of the original 24 CIM missionaries resigned in sympathy with Nickel. At around the same time, two other CIM missionaries complained that it was dangerous for so many unmarried men and women to live together at New Lane, the CIM headquarters in China. They accused Hudson of being too familiar with the young ladies, because Hudson and his wife Maria kissed some of the girls in the foyer before they went off to bed. Remember, this is a very hostile foreign environment. People are being cursed every day, they're being shouted at, they're meeting hostility. A bit of encouragement and warmth amongst the Christians was expected. But the ladies themselves denied there was any inappropriate behavior, but still the complaint reached London, and for a time it led to a fall off in support for the mission, which of course translates to less Chinese receiving the gospel. And this is the kind of nonsense they have to put up with. In spite of constant controversies, the number of CIM missionaries steadily grew. In time, it became the largest mission organization in the world. By 1900, China Inland Mission was the largest mission in history. Then Timothy Richard, a Welsh Baptist, began to cause further divisions within CIM, arguing that God also walks through other religions. Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, God's working through those religions too. More likely the devil. A handful of CIM missionaries were influenced by Richard's liberal views, and they left the mission. As Hudson began sending unmarried single women into the interior, another storm of controversy and criticism erupted. How can you send single women into the interior of China? And the courage of these tenacious young pioneers cannot be exaggerated. Annie Royal Taylor, who's no relation to Hudson Taylor, even though she's got the same surname, was one of the many bold individualists who joined CIM and set his sights on taking the gospel to the forbidden city of Lhasa in the heart of Tibet. that was about as inaccessible edge of the earth as you could get to. And she adopted native Tibetan dress, shaved her head in the fashion of a Tibetan nun. Bandits stole her tent and her clothing and killed most of her pack horses. Some of her workmen died, others turned back, but she persevered. One of her Chinese workmen demanded more money, and when that was refused, he brought accusations against her to the Tibetan authorities, which led to her arrest. Annie Taylor finally established her own agency, the Tibetan Pioneer Mission, recruiting 14 missionaries to work with her. But less than a year, all had left her, and her infant mission was in a shambles. However, Annie Taylor continued for more than 20 years, working mostly alone in Tibet. Now, the reason why I'm giving these details is, all too often, missionary biographies just tell you about the joys and the successes. But that's no good, because then when we meet problems, we think, oh, you know, Hudson Taylor and David Livingstone never had any problems. You know, everything I heard about them was just like, they just soared on victory after victory, but it's not true. So to realistically prepare people for missions, we need to recognize the fact that all missionaries face opposition, defeat, discouragement, delays. This is part of it. It's part of the job description. We must not get discouraged when we find opposition, delays, failures, and problems. We must meet it with the expectancy of, right, now, how's the Lord going to get us out of this one, and what can I do to solve this problem? This is another challenge. It's like an obstacle course. Okay, there's got to be a way. How do we get over this one? How do we get through this? How do we get around this? And so Annie Taylor continued for more than 20 years working mostly alone in Tibet. She didn't go home saying, well, everyone else abandoned me, there's nothing else for it. She stayed. Extraordinary. Now, Hudson Taylor did not make a distinction between married and single women. He expected married women to focus primarily on ministry, even as the single sisters did. Again, controversial, again, got him criticism, but they had very high standards in China Inland Mission. This is a picture late in Hudson Taylor's life. Hudson Taylor's now a really old man at this party, presumably it's maybe his birthday, and you can see the people gathering. Now, he's still in Chinese dress. Some people around are, for this occasion, they're not out ministering. They're wearing European dress, sometimes in their own fellowships. To male recruits, he wrote, unless you intend your wife to be a true missionary, not merely a wife, homemaker, and friend, don't join us. Maria set the pace for the other married woman in the mission, caring for 5 children, actively reaching out to Chinese women and daily outreach. I mean, these people are really very dedicated people. The Victorian era was an era of duty, honor, country, reaching out. They were very self-sacrificed, very high work ethic in the Victorian era, which I think is just one reason why the 19th century was such a spectacularly successful missionary century. In 1870, the Taylor's son Samuel died. Then their 5th son, Noel, died 2 weeks after being born. A few days later, Maria Taylor died at a mere age 33. 4 of Maria's 8 children died before they could reach age 10. This has got to be the worst part of missions in the 19th century. Medical advances were not such as they are today. And, for example, of Adoniram Judson, out of his 10 children, 5 died. Nothing could have been more traumatic for these missionaries than burying their own children and their wife. But that happened. And we can praise God. A life expectancy today in our health of missionaries field is far better than it ever has been before. But at this stage, there was no ease of transport and there was no access to this, even the simple hygiene we've got today. But they still did it. And without that sacrifice, the church in China would not be what it is today. Hudson Taylor returned to England and he married Jenny Faulding. He suffered an accident which left him with a damaged spine. But even while recovering and immobile, he refused to be idle. Prayer and planning filled his time. China is not to be won for Christ by quiet, ease-loving men and women. The stamp of men and women we need is such as will put Jesus Christ, China, and souls first and foremost in everything. Even life itself must be secondary. This is what a Chinese church looked like at that stage. As someone who'd literally given all to Christ in China, he found it impossible to expect any lesser commitment from others. Hudson Taylor was frequently accused of being demanding and autocratic. But in his mind, he is merely anxious to protect the integrity of the mission. This is obviously some problem. You see, if you've got an idea of what's a good pastor's compassionate, understanding, patient, you know, like your cell group leader, your Bible study leader, and so on. And now a person thinks a mission is just like my church. But now a mission leader is very different from a pastor. Mm-hmm. He's not patient and compassionate about my failings. He's pushing me and demanding, and he's concerned for stewardship of time and resources and opportunities. Mm-hmm. He's thinking of the Lord, the sending churches, the people who need our services of our mission. And so the mission does not exist for the benefit of the missionaries. The church might seem to exist for the benefit of its members. Well, actually, it's meant to exist for the Great Commission too. But most people's experience of local church ill prepares them for missions, because they assume that missions is going to be one long church service like it is spread through the week now. So I'm going to have like a cell group where everyone's affirming and building me up and making me feel good about myself. But a mission can't be like that. It's got to be deadlines, goals, key result areas, productivity, work ethic, dedication, self-sacrifice. All of these things are unpleasant. Who wants them? And so you can understand every mission leader is accused of being a good mission leader, yes. Otherwise, the money will disappear into the floor like water into the sand. In spite of constant poor health, regular bouts of depression, and a self-confessed irritation and impatience, he could also show tremendous flexibility and steadfastness under trial. Now, there's very many people see irritation and impatience as a great sin. And if you were to list your worst sins, a Westerner would normally put lying, laziness, high up on the list of terrible sins. But most Easterners would put the worst sins would be irritation, irritability, impatience, because they are shame and honor type of cultures. And so the worst thing you could do is to show impatience or irritation. Now, from a Western perspective, those are minor sins. In fact, it might not even be a sin. Because if you irritate a person for the fact that he's lying or he's wasting his time or he's late, and this is part of you trying to bring up a higher standard. You're trying to get the people to adhere to a higher goal. And yet, and many people could say, well, who's he to talk? Sure, I'm late and lazy, but he's impatient and rude. Which of course is much worse than my minus one. So again, it's people's ideas of what's more important. And yes, I would think that every mission leader I've studied had a problem with irritability and impatience, because there's so much at stake. You're wasting time, you're wasting resources. They want to stop this. They're concerned to be good stewards. And therefore, they will be irritable, rude, impatient, demanding, all things which the average Christian think is terrible. My cell group leader never spoke to me like that. Hudson and Jenny Taylor presented an incredible example of dedication when they were bequeathed several thousand pounds. They gave it all to the mission. Could have said, well, this is our private money, but straight into mission. They were frequently separate from one another and engaged in demanding journeys and a relentless schedule of ministry. Very serious people. Still, Hudson Taylor could declare at the end of his life, the sun had never risen upon him in China without finding him a prayer. Can you imagine? Every morning he was up before the sun praying. I don't know how many people could say anything like that about any of us. That's just extraordinary. In your whole life, it's hard enough to do it in a 3-week course, to keep this up for a lifetime. There was an urgency in everything he did. He was a man of faith who stated that his life was based upon three facts. There is a living God. He has spoken in the Bible. He means what he says, and he will do all that he has promised. Isn't that a great 3-point program for anybody's life? In a letter to his mother, Hudson Taylor described his own assessment of his life in these words: envied of some, despised by many, hated perhaps by others. There's no perhaps about it, but I think he's trying to be kind to his mother. Often blamed for things I never heard of or had nothing to do with, and innovative things which have become established rules of missionary practice. That's true. He innovated a lot of things which everyone criticized him for at the time, and later the same missions that criticized him adopted the same strategies. An opponent of mighty systems of heathen error and superstitions, working without precedent in many respects, and with few experienced helpers, often sick in body as well as perplexed in mind and embarrassed by circumstances. Had not the Lord been specifically gracious to me, had not my mind been sustained by the conviction that this work is his, and that he is with me in the thick of the conflict, I must have fainted and broken down. But the battle is the Lord's and he must conquer. We may fail. We do fail continually. But he never fails. Indeed, by the end of his life, the very mission organizations that had belittled and ridiculed his methods had begun adopting many of them. By the time Hudson Taylor died, there were 205 China inland mission stations, as indicated on this map, 849 full-time missionaries, and 125,000 Chinese Christians organized in China inland mission congregations. That's absolutely phenomenal achievement considering what they were up against and the resistance they faced. Some of their missionaries. And here's his 24, the famous 24 that he prayed for at Brighton Beach. And here you can see some of the famous missionaries who came out dressed in the Chinese dress. Houston Dixter is one of the Cambridge Seven, one of the friends of C.T. Studd, who took over as the second director of China Inland Mission after Hudson Taylor. Many different missionary volunteers. Here you can see them all in their Chinese dresses, the kind of way they'd normally have ministered. Hudson Taylor and his wife, Jenny, second wife. These are different missionary couples who went out to China and ministered under Hudson Taylor. This man, just look at the change as a youngster as he joined. Now, same person, that's with his wife and children. Can you see the similarity? And here's the same man in the end of his life. Okay, I'll go back. See the features? And this is the same man. In fact, here's his, where's his name here? I've got it. J.J. Meadows. That's right, the Meadows family. James Joseph Meadows. Just one of the families gave a lifetime to China. And extraordinary families. You can see he's got... he's shaved his head in the Chinese way, growing the moustache in the Chinese way. Literature, ministry, Bible. In fact, this is the Bible Translation Committee, consisting of Chinese and missionaries working together on the translation of Bible in Chinese. Hudson Taylor and his wife Jenny with some of the Chinese believers. These are evangelists that they had trained. So, because he went to the end of the 19th century, we have got photographs of Hudson Taylor's ministry more than we have of many others. Tibetan mission and Hudson Taylor's funeral. You see some of the Chinese believers gathered. One of the greatest attacks on Christianity ever in the history of China was the Boxer Rebellion, 1900. In 1900, they murdered hundreds of missionaries and Christians in China. It was the big xenophobic reaction of all xenophobics. This was the worst. You might have heard of 50 Days in Peking. There's a major film with Charlton Heston in it. And just 52 Days in Peking. Well, this was particularly targeting every foreigner, but the Christians suffered the worst, and not just the missionaries. I think China Inland Mission lost 182 missionaries killed in the Boxer Uprising. But not only them, but thousands of Chinese Christians were killed by the Boxers. It was absolutely hideous. And you had the first and only time in history that the German army and the Austrian army and the Russian army and the British army and the Japanese and the French all worked together to go in and rescue the foreigners and bring them out of China from that hideous Boxer Rebellion. So the greatest century of missions ended with the devil's counterattack. But that's not the end of the story. China Inland Mission has changed its name since to Overseas Missionary Fellowship. Here's a 1931, 60 women volunteers to CIM. CIM, being the first mission to accept single women, became mostly women missionaries after a while. It became an extraordinarily successful mission and the first destination for many women. By the time the communist Chinese took over in 1949, there were 8,000 missionaries in China. And that's after the Second World War, which had, you know, of course many would have left. But of course, you might remember the most famous missionary to China after Hudson Taylor would be. Sorry?
Gladys
Ellen would be another one. But I was thinking of the Olympic athlete who had made chariots of fire over, Eric Liddell. He went to China after winning the Olympics gold in 1924, and he lived the rest of his life in China. He was born in China. His parents were Scottish missionaries to China. And Eric Liddell died in the Japanese concentration camp during the Second World War. Extraordinary story. We've got the full documentary on his life, which is absolutely extraordinary. Far more than what this film Chariots of Fire, which just gives a glimpse at a few months in his life. But he was a great hero of the church in China. Hudson Taylor said, "The Great Commission is not an option to be considered. It is a command to be obeyed." So when you meet somebody who says, "I said to the Lord when I was young, I'll go anywhere, I'll do anything, but the Lord's never called me," I have trouble believing that one. You know, here this person was with motives as pure as the driven snow. Willing, ready, available. But God just dropped the ball. I mean, he would have done anything the Lord told him, but the Lord just... And he's so spiritual, he wouldn't do anything until this, the Lord personally came and gave him a gold ticket invitation. Hudson Taylor would say to such a person, "What do you need a call for? You've got a command." God's man in God's place, doing God's will to God's glory, will never lack for God's support. This is one of the faith mission's first battle cries. God's work done God's way will not lack God's supplies, a simple way of putting it. Hudson Taylor also said, "God's servant is God's responsibility." You worry about God's work, he'll worry about your support. Well, we've got quite a bit on Hudson Taylor and Great Ascension Missions and in the Victorious Christians. This mission has been going since 1865. By the way, I met Hudson Taylor III. He was the, I think he's the great-grandson of Hudson Taylor. And he is the director of China Inland Mission when I met him, which was in the 80s. I'm not sure who the head would be right now. What's now called Overseas Missionary and Fellowship. There's a lot of great books on this. I'm just pointing my Christian History magazine here. There's a whole lot of very interesting things you can get. Christian History did something on Hudson Taylor a while back. And amongst the different things that they pointed out, which is quite interesting, is the first missionaries to China were, of course, the Nestorians back in the 600s already. Nestorians were very effective there, but they got almost annihilated by the Mongol invasions and absolutely massacred. There were millions of Chinese Christians back in the first millennium, but they got annihilated. Well, along came a Franciscan monk in 1294. So this is the first Catholic attempted missions. And his way of getting missionaries done in China, I mean, just to show the contrast between Catholic ways of doing missions and Protestants. This Catholic missionary, John of Monte Corvino, he got his converts by buying young children from the non-Christian parents. He'd come in, "How much for your child?" And he'd buy them, like, you know, you could buy any product. People would sell their kids into slavery. And he got 6,000 children that he bought. And then he brought them up as Christians, Roman Catholics.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. He did this in 11 years. For 11 years, he worked in China. And during that time, he baptized 6,000 children, most of which he had just purchased. How's that for a design of missions? The first Protestant missionary to China was Robert Morrison. He is from Scotland. He came in 1807. And it was illegal to be a missionary. It was illegal to learn Chinese. It was illegal to teach Chinese. It was forbidden to do just about everything. And forbidden for any foreign woman to be in China. And so the men, he was separated from his wife for years at a time. And interesting also how the Protestants, when the Protestants went to China, they aimed at the lowest of the low. They went for the laborers and they went for the opium addicts. And they brought them to the Lord. When the Catholics went to China, later, we're talking about now the missions in the 1600s of Ricci and others, they went to the intelligentsia, the most educated elite, and they trained them. And the Catholics basically had high-class churches, and the Protestants basically had low-class churches. Just interesting, the different styles of ministry. Today, it is believed that there is well over 100 million Christians in China. Well over 100 million. When Hudson Taylor died, he had 125,000 Christians organized in his mission churches. By the time the communists took over, there was less than 1 million Protestants and 3 million Catholics. Catholics have done better through their strategy. Not that that equals born again, but they had more numbers. Today, they believe, the Bible-believing evangelical born-again Christians in China exceed 100 million. We're less than 1 million Protestants in China in 1949. There's 100 million today. Why would the church in China have exploded 100-fold in the last 60 years?
Persecution.
Yes, persecution, but not only persecution.
But I believe that, the sacrifice of the missionaries and the sacrifice of the early believers.
I think that's it. Yeah. Unless a grain of wheat falls in the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it does die, it produces a great harvest. We had hundreds of missionaries die in the Boxer Rebellion. Martyred for Christ, not counting the others who died, also by xenophobic attacks. Hundreds of missionaries laid down their life for Christ in China, including right into the Second World War, and you think of people like Eric Little, martyred for Christ. The ground in China was so plowed and sown and with the blood of the martyrs. The sacrifice that missionaries had poured into China for generations, that although all missionaries were kicked out in 1949, the church has increased 100-fold since then. But that couldn't have been possible without all that work beforehand. But consider this. Removing the missionaries at that point was good, because they'd done their job, they'd laid the foundations, the roots went down deep, they'd plowed, they'd sown, they'd sacrificed. Now they weren't there to do the work for the Chinese Christians. The Chinese couldn't be bottle-fed and hand-fed and everything else. They couldn't have their nappies changed and have everything done for them by the missionaries. Now they had to do everything for themselves. And that's a good way to learn. And at this point, the Chinese Christians just grew and multiplied 100-fold in the last 60 years.
There's a missionary in China now. His name is Wu. He comes from Brazil, and he gave himself 3 months to learn the Mandarin language. And in 3 months, he mastered the language to speak it. when our group was there last year, he was still learning how to write and read it properly. But 3 months to speak the Mandarin language fluently. And they spoke about, they also went into the interior of China, and they spoke about the rural places of China. What happens is, as the kids grow up, they go to the cities because they want the lights, they want the life, and they leave their parents and they leave the elders in the interior of China. Yeah. And they can't provide for themselves because they have their fields, but they're too old to sow it. And they met the man there that was sitting next to his coffin. He's just waiting to die. The old man is just sitting next to his coffin and he's just waiting to die in the interior of China.
Sure. Well, you can see there's a lot of great books written on Hudson Taylor and by Hudson Taylor and classics and reprinting. But what is going on right now in China today is extraordinary. Some of the worst persecution of Christians, but some of the strongest church growth. But why is there such a strong church in China? There were a lot of very dedicated, sacrificial people who sowed their lives into China, and we seeing the fruit today. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
Ministry in, say, Japan, not really.
Nothing to compare with what's gone to China. China was the premier missionary destination of the greatest century of missions. In the greatest century of missionaries, more missionaries went to China than anywhere else.
Wow.
The largest group of people, the biggest unreached group in the world.
And also,
the superstars of the age went to China. You know, C.T. Studd, it was the whole Cambridge Seven, the Hudson Taylor. So that's why when David Livingston was training for missions, he was thinking China, China, China. That's all he was thinking the whole way along. And it's only the Opium War that forced him to redirect to Africa, which, as far as I can see, is a God incident. I really believe David Livingston would have been wasted in China. Africa was made for him, and he was made for Africa. But, I mean, that's another matter.
Just read an article recently by a Chinese sociologist, not a Christian, and he said that they've been studying in sociology in China for the last 20 years, trying to understand why the West leapfrogged over China during the 18th and 19th century, because they consider themselves a more superior civilization.
Oh, yes.
All right, and he says this has been a great concern to them. Why? What happened in the West that just catapulted them forward? And they came up with many different theories, but the final theory was the faith of the West,
yeah,
the Christian faith. And he ends his article by saying, isn't it interesting that which the Chinese believe progressed the West are forsaking while China is embracing?
That is very ironic.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It is indeed.
Yeah.
That's the point. And the West thinks that somehow it's innately Europe and America that makes them so successful,
yeah,
free, powerful, productive, prosperous. But it's not so. It's the gospel roots. And they cut themselves off from the gospel roots like cutting the flower out of the flower bed. Putting it in a vase, it looks very nice, but it's not going to last.
Yeah.
The flower will fade. And we are in a cut flower generation.
Yeah.
Where our generation, in our society, has cut themselves off from the root of all of their power and energy, and they cannot last. And we're starting to see the fading already. Yes?
My Afrikaans Bible is a very good example of what our missionary work did in China. This has been printed in China, recycled to us.
That is really amazing. There's now, if I want to print a Bible, say I want to print 10,000 Bibles for Sudan, which I have wanted to do, like with a Moro Bible, it would cost me 5 to 6 times more to print it in Kenya, which is closest country with decent printing presses to Sudan. So the next cheapest the cheapest place was actually China, but I would not do that. But South Korea, Indonesia, Singapore are where we've gotten our Bibles printed, because they will do it cheaper, even with the shipping costs to Africa, than we can do it in Africa, which is because they've got a higher work ethic over there, and they don't have the same labor union nonsense that we've got, which is terrible. I've said to Kenyans, I would prefer to give you the business. And it's closer, it's more convenient for me, but your taxes are so high, and your prices are so high, and your unit price. I can buy 5 to 6 Bibles for every one that I can do if I print it in Kenya by getting it printed in Singapore or South Korea. I'm not even going to talk about China. I will not get something printed in China out of principle, because I think it's immoral to put money in the hands of slave traders. And that's effectively what is. China can undercut everybody because they got slave labor. You don't have to pay your laborers. Of course they can undercut everyone's prices. Just like William Carey would not use sugar, because sugar was made with slave labor at that time. So I believe we can't support products from China if we can avoid it. And that's one of my concerns, because many times it's like Christian brethren being forced to work for nothing but food and accommodation in a slave camp.
Earlier on in one of the slides referring to CIM, I think I saw OMF.
China Inland Mission, when it was kicked out of China, had to change its name because they now couldn't work in China. Of course, they moved to Formosa or Taiwan, which is where the Republic of China fled to. And then they start working in other parts of Asia, so they call themselves Overseas Missionary Fellowship. So OMF today is CIM renamed. Yeah.
Also, referring to things about China, Apple computers actually see slavery, but they,
I don't know about this, please tell me. You're talking about people who are making the computers, who are assembling them?
Yes, yeah, so they sleep and work and sleep and work at their desk. So there's a lot of slavery, and that's why people don't...
Is this in China?
Yes.
I did not know that.
I think it's China.
There's a lot of things we need to know about this, because China has got one of the most oppressive governments in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that most products we get, for example, any toys from McDonald's or Disney seem to be made in China, just for starters.
Is it the right name for the company?
I didn't know Apple Mac did that.
Yeah, okay.
That is shocking. If you please, if you get interesting piece of information like this, do just forward us to us electronically. We really appreciate all the research we can get. Some people send us absolute gems which we are not aware of. There's so much going on in the world that when you find an important piece of information like this, please pass it on. Even if I've got from somewhere else, it'll do no harm. But often I've never heard of it before. This is how we develop our information. Yes, John.
I think it's interesting to see how different David Livingstone, William Carey, and Hudson Taylor are. While I'm sure all of those men are overcomers and people who would persevere, they would do exceptionally well wherever they're placed, but they seem to have just been placed exactly the right place. And it sort of makes up that proverb true that says in Proverbs 3, trust in the Lord with all your heart and not under your own understanding, with all your ways and knowledge, and will direct your path. It's like God, you find God's will when you get busy about God's work.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of pushes you in the direction you want to go. David Livingstone wanted to go to China, but he was just there willing and he was getting ready to work for God.
I do believe that if Hudson Taylor had come to Africa, he would have been a failure. And I don't think David Livingstone would have been much of a success, not on the same level as he was in Africa if he was in China. I think they were made for those countries, uniquely. And it's just inconceivable to think of William Carey going to any other place in India. You know, it's like they were made for that field, and that field is made for them, and this is the fit. So while when we think of God's will, we're not normally just thinking geography, but we're thinking my attitudes must be right with God. But once that's settled, God has his place, his best place, where we can flourish.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember Professor Brandon, who was the guy that trained me up in the army? I was a disciple on the East here for 2 years. And this guy had art for China. And he was praying for a while that he would be someone that would have a heart for China. And they're still looking now up in Angola and all those places like that. Their aim is to go to China in the end.
Good. Well, praise God for everything that's been done in China and that still has to be done now. These days, the Chinese church is so strong that the best thing we can do is to provide them with support, prayer, resources, materials, you know, whether it's electronically, these digital Bibles. I mean, there's so many things like the whole Bible in Chinese that they can download onto their phones. And there's all sorts of incredible techniques. And I know of some phenomenal technology that MAF is using, making available to them, literally that they can put into the cell phone everything they need, the Bible studies, commentaries, and all of that. It's all there. And they've even got ways that they can delete it when found, by communist officials before they can search. And they've worked out some very clever technology to get in to these places. And we need to support the church in China, but we no longer need to be going there to do church planting.
Mm-hmm.
But we can go there to enrich them and strengthen them and back them up. That's a very mature church.
That's right. A huge amount of China is coming into our country.
Well, mission field in many cases. I think that, now, I should say, when I was at the Luzon Congress 3, which is Cape Town 2010 Missions Conference, the largest missions conference in history, most representative missions conference ever. But As with all other Lausanne Congresses, 1, 2, and 3, not a single Chinese delegate was there. The Chinese government mobilized their entire security police to just stop them all. They were stopped airports. There was over 380 Chinese delegates who should have been there. They blocked them all. They caught them all. And they were going in so many different ways. The only people we had representing Chinese people were Chinese people who lived outside of China. But nobody from inside China got out. And that's not all. As we started the Lausanne Congress, which was not just the biggest conference in terms of, we had 197 countries represented here in Cape Town, but there were going to be 100,000 other delegates at different locations around the world having live feeds, and the first day it collapsed. And everyone was complaining that South Africa's infrastructure wasn't adequate to accommodate, and soon just found, no, we were facing the first cyber war in history. We know about cyber war in theory. They bombarded, there were millions of hostile hits that came into the computer system at the Cape Town Conference Center and basically overloaded and wiped out the circuits. So that everything that was meant to be broadcast live around the world at the same time failed. Just the entire computer system crashed in the whole Cape Town Conference Center, which is so advanced. There was nothing wrong with the system. I was getting the daily feed for this, us also having media card and able to go into all the media and found out the whole story behind the scenes. But when we knew about this, I said to the people in charge, so who's doing this? And they said, well, we can't say. And I said, is it China? Yes, but you can't print that. Well, it is China. I did print it. The fact is China absolutely, they didn't just stop the people going there, they attacked it. Now, to think that the Chinese government sees the church as a threat, praise God that there is a church in the world that is perceived as a threat by evil governments. And how disgraceful if evil rulers don't see the church as a threat and think, you know, they're irrelevant, they're dead dog or puppy, you know, what are they to us? But the Chinese government sees that Christian church is the biggest threat. To think they would have unleashed the first cyber war in history, it just shows the importance of the internet as well. And a missions conference, I was glad that a missions conference wasn't considered irrelevant by the Chinese government. They showed their hand, and there were American military heading there to look at. I mean, we saw it there in the whole center. It's phenomenal. There was a huge hall just filled with all the technical gadgets that was handling all this, and people coming from all over the place, you know, military attaches and so on from the US Embassy. How was this done? You know, they're fascinated because they're all preparing for this to happen one day. But here's an example. China showed their hand and showed their techniques, showed their capabilities, and they used a missions conference to do it. It's quite a story, and I'm just saying praise God for the Church of China.
And it's so impressive, just the simple fact like they've blocked Facebook out of the country. You cannot even go on Facebook if you are in China.
Yeah.
It's completely blocked up.
On another related point, we had some good friends from South Africa who went to work in Arab Emirates. Quite a lot, you know, affirmative action, very hard to get jobs here. So quite a lot of guys headed out. And he said he was trying to go on the frontline web and he couldn't access it. Mm-hmm. Trying to go on the frontline Facebook, couldn't. And he'd go off. When he went out, and thought maybe this, when he went to another country nearby, I think India or whatever, worked. Goes back to Arab Emirates, didn't work, back to his board. And so he said, they must be deliberately blocking frontline fellowship out of the United Arab Emirates. I thought, well, praise God. Another interesting thing, we just launched Joy Magazine electronically recently, and on the first day, the first 200 subscriptions electronically came from China. Which was bizarre. Our websites, we get different breakdowns, and I've seen that China is always in the top 10 of the top 10 countries that access frontline websites. But it's of course a huge country, so in one sense you'd expect it. But China is one of our always top 10. Interesting.
Venezuela.
What blocks us? No idea. Of course, that's a communist country, isn't it? Chavez. Yeah. Well, you're not just known by your friends. You're also known by your enemies.